Hey everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Retro Raw Rundown. I know we're a little bit late, and I'm sorry. I'm not really sorry. It's still here. It's just we had a retro pay-per-view to do, and we have like stuff going on. Like
stuff goes on.
Sandra has to like work. She has to like comb her hair that is
that
made
takes
from
a really long time.
Lions. She has to have sex with Mr. Sandra. She has to clean up wine that she spills at the liquor store.
Thankfully, that hasn't happened in a few weeks.
She has to navigate the Facebook community page, which she barely knows how to work.
It's very, very confusing and overwhelming. It's really cool, and the discussions that I've seen are awesome, but I'm just not very good. Like, part of it is that I'm very bad at focusing. And so I see that there are just so many comments and, you know, this person has tagged you in a comment and this person's having a really interesting conversation. And also there are 50 comments on this really interesting conversation. And that's just a lot to handle when you're me.
Yeah, you get to a point where you just kind of like, you breeze through comments, you know, and you find the ones that really work for you, like for whatever reason.
To get to that point, like I have barely figured out how to just breeze through Twitter. That's why I don't even follow 200 people because it's too confusing.
One of my favorites was Philip Kelstall, I think the surname is. I actually pronounce. I don't know if that's the right. I'm always very wary of pronouncing names, but he posted a thing about like, you know, which wrestlers have you met who've been like an arsehole? And somebody had said, like he'd had one about, like, he met Kevin Nash at an indie show and he asked him for a photo and Kevin Nash said no because he stank of cigar smoke. And then he said, really? And then Nash was like, £50 might twist my arm.
That seems like the most Kevin Nash thing in the world, actually.
Which is exactly what Andrew Bartley said, where he was like, that's the most Kevin Nash story I've ever heard. Bubba Ray obviously came up eventually, because he usually comes up in these conversations.
Right.
And for whatever reason, I don't know why it popped me so much, was Philip had responded to that. He was like, yeah, I hear a lot of Bubba Ray bastard vibes, but I've met him and he was, well, I mean, I don't get a Christmas card off him, but he was fine and reasonable. He always seems very tired. I think he's quite a tired person. And that tweet, for that message, for whatever reason, just made me laugh.
That
so you get
funny.
To these comments and you just things make you laugh. And yeah. Then
no, you know, I'm enjoying scrolling through the Facebook group and seeing the conversations that people are having. I didn't really get that much of a chance to do it today because I was out with my family because, you know, it's Mother's Day here in America. And can I just like, can I rant about Mother's Day to you for just like a moment?
Absolutely.
Okay. So in the past couple days at work, I'm so glad I didn't have to work today, right? Because on Friday and Saturday, not being Mother's Day, I was wished Happy Mother's Day multiple times. I'm not a mother. I have zero children. But people, like, see me and they see a ring on my finger and assume, oh, you must be procreating because that's what women do, right? And, like, I haven't, so it just doesn't apply. So people are like, oh, Happy Mother's Day. And I'm like, thank you? And so, but yesterday there was this woman who, like, I did a whole transaction with her. She bought some Michelob Ultra, which, whatever, if you have a shitty taste in beer, that's fine. I'm not going to judge you. You're like an old lady.
Yes, you are.
And I am totally going to judge you, but whatever. And so, you know, but she's nice. Like, she comes in often, and she's, you know, kind of a nice hippie old lady, and I like her. So she's on her way out. She stops at the counter, like, on the way out the door, and just, like, leans over. She goes, are you a mother? And I just go, no. And
you do not look like a mother.
I don't,
at all.
Do I? Right? Like, I just wear wrestling shirts and jeans constantly at my work. Like, I don't look like a matronly woman.
I mean,
so much.
You look like you would. You look like you would be, and not aesthetically, but like the way that you carry yourself and the way that you can dress. I see you as like Roseanne's sister,
Jackie.
Yeah, you're like Jackie.
I could.
That's what I see.
I could see it. I mean, she eventually had a kid too, but like, I just
still time, son.
Whatever. But,
you're only 46.
What? Did you say I was 46?
Sorry, I saw your passport in Orlando. Anyway, continue.
Whatever. Anyway, Kenny McIntosh, just because you're younger than me, trying to give me shit about it. I'm the one who's fine with my age, Mister. I was born in 1995, but.
Did you hear that Mel listened to Classic ITR and I was even annoyed about my age 5 years ago?
Oh, of course you were. You and Robert have both been annoyed about your age. Remember when we were all about to turn 30? Oh my gosh, I thought I was going to have to talk both of you down off a ledge.
To me, even Robert doesn't help himself. He dresses in tweed.
Well, no, I think Robert has accepted it by now and Robert's fine with it now. Like, you're still in this crisis situation. Like, I think maybe just Robert and I are just older and
wiser.
Does
working out mean it's a crisis?
No, working out doesn't mean it's a crisis. You complaining constantly about your hair and the fact that your skin needs to be beautiful is like a crisis.
I didn't say beautiful. I just said my skin needs to not resemble sandpaper. Why is that a bad thing?
That's not a bad thing at all.
Just trying to better myself, Sandra.
Which is a laudable goal, Kenny. But anyway, this woman who has not... the woman who has not bettered herself as well as you have, she... you know, when I say no, because I'm tired of being wished Happy Mother's Day... goes, oh, like it was not what she was expecting. She was expecting for me to be like, oh yes, I have two wonderful children, or like 2.4 wonderful children, blah, 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 because I work in Cascade and that's what people think. And she was like, oh, well, make sure you wish your mother a happy Mother's Day then tomorrow. And I was just, I wish I hadn't been so stunned by it, because then she left, because I just went, okay. And she just left, and the look on my coworker's face, who actually had my dad for a teacher, so, like, he knows the whole situation, the look on his face was priceless. And I really wish I hadn't been so stunned, so I could have come back with, well, she's dead, but okay. Like, think before you speak, people. Just think before you speak. It is great to wish your mother a happy Mother's Day. It's great to wish women who have children happy Mother's Day. Congratulations on having born these children. Women who have adopted children and have children in their lives and are really happy about it. That's great for them. Mother's Day is a great time to celebrate your mother.
Men who have adopted a baby with another man who want to take the feminine role.
That too. Fine. Like... whatever. It's a great time to celebrate
motherhood
and mothers and all of that. But don't just, like, look at a woman and assume, oh, well, you must be a mother because you look like you're in your 30s and you're married. So clearly you must have children. And then also don't assume that anyone's mothers are just still alive if we're, you know, not super old or whatever. Like, it's just think before you speak. I'm really shocked, actually, yesterday that I didn't have to explain my reasoning for not having children, because that's another thing people will ask me regularly is, oh, you don't have kids? Why not? But, like, why not? And I'm like, this is so none of your business.
See, it's interesting because I have a couple of friends you included who sadly lost their mothers. And I always think with that kind of stuff that, like, the best way to handle these situations is to never assume in any way, because, like, you know, you don't know people are going to handle it. Some people, you know, like you, have a stunned silence. Some people might break down. You just never know. So,
well, and there would have been years that I would have broken down. I never know how I'm going to feel on Mother's Day. Some years I'm fine. Like this year, I had a lovely dinner with my grandma and my stepmom and, like, my mom's side of the family, actually. We all went out, and it was lovely, and it was
shared
a great day.
Shared some nice memories.
Shared some nice memories, you know, had some nice coffee, whatever. Like, it was a great day. Some years, I don't feel super great on Mother's Day, and it really, really sucks. And I don't understand why people feel that they can just, like, assume things.
I mean, I do just want to say, Sandra had put up... an adorable little picture of her and her mum on Facebook yesterday, where her mum is rocking the shit out of a perm.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was 1989. I mean...
and Sandra's got these wee shoes on with a wee bowl cut. Oh, my God. She was like a spaniel. It was great. But my version of this, which is not anywhere near as awful, I guess, as yours, is... So I feel like I should share some information here. You just shared that your mother's no longer with us. I feel like I should share something else as well. So my thing is, I've never met my dad. I don't know who he is. I've never come across him in life. And the reason is because my mother and him, they fucked, essentially. And
well, I was guessing that they did, because you exist, but...
well, I mean, it could have been an immaculate conception, but you never know. Yes, anyway, so they pumped, and then, you know, I was a thing. But she was like kind of seeing him at the time, and it wasn't too serious, but blah 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 blah. And then he was in some trouble, I think, with like the police or something, and he was going to go on the run, and he like made this gesture to my mom, like, do you want to come with me? And she was like, no. So he left, and then she never told him that she was pregnant.
Oh.
So I've never met him. I've never seen a picture of him. I have no idea who he is. I have zero idea. Now, the interesting thing is my mom did go to a psychic about 10 years ago, and that psychic did say that either 4 years after I was born or 4 years before that psychic meeting that he found out that he did have a son somewhere. Anyway. The point is,
so what's interesting, the psychic can be trusted,
which I think she can, because I do believe in psychics, because mm-hmm. they know shit that you can't know otherwise. It's very weird. Like, I don't understand psychics. Anyway, I do understand them. I guess that's the problem. But what I would find over the years is whenever I would like be, you know, hanging out with people and whatever, you know, like your dad would come up in the conversation. I'd be, oh, I don't know my dad, and then they'd look at me and be like, I'm really sorry. I'm like, why are you sorry? What are you sorry for? And they're like, you've never met your dad. And I'm being treated like he's died. I'm like, I don't know who this person is.
Right, it's like, not someone that you've ever had a connection to.
You are as attached to him as I am. He's by all accounts, a fictional person at this point. So, yeah. But then every time, it's like you have to have this long fucking drawn out where they're like, are you okay? Yeah, I'm fine.
That's almost the worst, because even like, you know, when people find out, you know, oh, well, yeah, like my mom died when I was little. And yeah, that was really hard. But do I really want to have a whole conversation with you about it? Like, I don't need to be consoled by you.
You need to open up to me. Like, yeah, I don't need to open up to my close friends. I'll open up to you.
Right.
I say that customer at work,
you are the one that I definitely need to tell about my life story.
I do say that as I've just opened up about a very personal situation that my mum pumped something and then he ran away on a podcast that thousands of people are listening to. But hopefully you people won't somehow meet my mother. And listen, Gary, who knows my mum, if you're listening to this, don't fucking blab to her again like you did last time.
Oh, is he the one that told your mum when you
were
talking
about... You're the one that went and told my mum that I was talking about a boyfriend who I'm not a big fan of. And then she came to me and completely said, why are you talking about me in a podcast? I'm like, how the fuck do you know? Gary told me. Well, shut up, Gary, essentially.
Shut up, Gary. Come on.
Because if you do that
don't
again,
be a dick.
I'll take away privileges. You know, if you want to meet Big Bad Bill in June, I can make that happen. Just saying. Anyway. 12 minutes in, not a hint of wrestling chat.
You know, but people like our banter.
They do. I also do feel, though, that, and you might not want to say this publicly, but I feel like ever since David, you know, in the Raw rundown, basically threw out like a banter gauntlet a little bit, I feel like you've been a little bit like, wait a minute here. I'm going to throw out some banter here. And people are noticing it, Sandra. People are talking about it.
Maybe I felt a little inadequate in the banter department. Maybe I'm trying to overcompensate.
Now you're The Rock. You're just bringing it. That's what you're doing.
Compare me to The Rock. Choose someone better than that, please.
So, before we get into the podcast, I do just want to say very quickly a few kind of housekeeping things. Number one, I think that I have fallen in love with Randy Orton because of him on Twitter.
Boo!
She says that she is a big fan of him on Twitter off air. I'm just telling you. So,
I am a fan of him as a heel, as
she did call him
dickhead.
Amazing. Off air. Anyway.
I said his Twitter presence is amazing for a heel. Boo! Boo, Randy Orton.
My favorite thing was, so Bubba Ray Dudley tweeted out a thing where it was like him doing a dive onto the ROH guys, and then like Randy Orton like tweeted it back saying something like, you know, valiant young guy diving, this is an old vet falling or something like that. And
he said an out of shape old vet or something.
Out of shape old vet. And
I even have it in front of me. I just looked at Twitter. Lol, there is a difference between a young, hungry talent diving and an old, out of shape, quote unquote, vet, ... falling.
But luckily, Bubba Ray is pretty quick to come back. So Bubba Ray's response to this, which I thought was pretty great, was, hey, Randy Orton, I didn't, my tweet had zero to do with you. Looks like you were wrong again. You're still awesome. And then under it, falling over House of Horrors.
Did you see that Cody Rhodes just tweeted them, be nice to each other?
Such a Cody thing to do. The nicest man. I remember Cody said to me once, he was like, you know, my brother's the nice one. And I'm like, how can he be the nice one? You're the nicest person I've ever met.
He like, seems so lovely. Like, I've never gotten to meet Cody Rhodes, but he just seems like a lovely person.
Yeah, he is.
And I know
he
that is. You know him, so you can actually speak to that more than I can. I just think he seems lovely.
Yeah, he is. He's a good friend to people. So, yeah, good guy. I don't want to jinx this. I'm not going to say his name, but a certain Original Recipe host has reached out that he would like to podcast. And I think we're podcasting tomorrow night, which means that we will get to hear him talk about... I'm going to just read something to you, ladies and gentlemen, of something that he said, and you can decipher who he's talking about and may want to bring up tomorrow if we do go ahead. He said... Great radio when I do this, isn't it?
It's absolutely great radio.
Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan. Silver Spoon fucker handed everything, earned nothing, voted Trump, fuck off. So you can take your guess about who he's talking about. But so we're going to be back tomorrow, hopefully. If not tomorrow, it'll be this week at some point. But we're going to do some Original Recipe. Also, you can go to patreon.com/insidetheropes. We are pretty much just about, I'm just going to check as we're here. Have we hit it yet? We're at 398 patrons. We're almost at 400, which is
that's exciting,
amazing.
So, I don't know if it's quite as exciting as 200 or 20,000 YouTube subscribers, but in a way, you know what? The Patreon number is almost more exciting to me because that means that people are actually taking their money that they've earned and supporting us and saying, I think so much of you guys that I'm willing to give you money, whether it's a dollar, whether it's, you know, $5, $7, whatever. I think it's really cool that people are actually, you know, saying, no, like, your show is worth it and I'm willing to support you. And I thank all of you. And I thank all of you who just, you know, download the show, obviously. And I thank everyone who subscribes on YouTube. But the Patreon subscribers, you're kind of a cool special club.
Yeah, no, it's. I never envisioned when we did it that it was going to be this popular. So
he genuinely, you guys, he thought that we would maybe get to 100 patrons, maybe. And when I suggested like a $5 tier and a $7 tier for extra content, he was like, "I don't think anybody's going to pay it, but okay, we'll try."
Yeah, it's baffling. Look for those numbers to go up, Duncan. They won't. Well, they might go up, inflation. But anyway,
We're not raising our prices on things.
We're
just
not.
To be clear.
I tell you this, if the fucking exchange rate goes tits up, we might have to.
We might have to. Well, we might just need to add like a new tier for other stuff.
Fuck.
Because of course
Make us do more.
Because we don't already talk about wrestling so much every week. I had to remind Kenny today that there's a SmackDown pay-per-view and a takeover this weekend, and that we also have to talk about NXT at some point this week. And that's why we really needed to get Retro Raw done today, so that we can get the next Retro Raw done fairly soon before all of these other things start happening.
And I just did two podcasts today, which I was going to plug there. Patreon.com/... One more time for the cheap seats in the back. patreon.com/insidetheropes is where we do extra content. Now, one of the cool perks of being there, we've not done this in a while, so I'm going to quickly go through it. If you pledge $1, you can pledge any amount that you want to us every month, but if you do $1 or more, you get access to the WrestleMania 6 review, which, good God.
it's so good. It is my favorite Inside the Rope show of all time.
And there's some competition there for the Royal Rumble and the Great Khali retrospective. Mm-hmm.
But WrestleMania 6 still clinches it for me. Also, Robert and David's Wrestle Kingdom, I think we put that up at the $1 level. Also, some takeover show we did at one point. Also, all of my show notes for Retro Raw.
Yes, you, so yeah, even if you just listen to Retro Rot and you want to like read Sandra's notes, because they're pretty detailed, they're all in there for the $1 level. But if you go up to $3 or more, you get all of that plus an interview that goes up every week. So we've had ones that have gone up from like Ahmed Johnson, J.J. Dillon, Jack Doan, Tommaso Ciampa, Jeff Jarrett, boo. So many people.
Kirsten Schaefer recently, though.
Kirsten
that
Schaefer.
That one's really good.
80 minutes long. Annie Hayes, who is a listener and a pledger and a subscriber and all those good things, she came to our Inside the Ropes meetup in Orlando, and she had mentioned that she's only been watching wrestling for like a year or two years, I think it was, and like she said the Carson Schaefer is her favorite interview we've done so far, which is really cool for me that she'd never watched that time period before, you know, because when I do these interviews, like, I'm always very, especially someone like Carson Schaefer, there's like a, I feel like there's an expectation level from some people, and then also there's a kind of a, I know some people are going to go into this maybe not expecting much, but I need to make sure that they come out of it really enjoying it. And most people, well, every bit of response so far has been great, so I really appreciate everyone who's checked that out. It's like 80 minutes long. Please go check it out. He talks about everything from Yokozuna sitting on him to, I kid you not, JBL doing the Nazi signal in Munich one night. It's crazy. So we talk about a bunch of shit on there. That's at the $3 level. $5 and up, you can get all that. Plus monthly retro pay-per-view reviews from Sandra and I, VIP specials.
You didn't even mention the brand-specific pay-per-views at the $3 level.
And at the $3 level, we get the brand-specific pay-per-views. David and I did Payback. Sandra and I were doing Backlash next week. So there's all that at the $3 level. Up to $5, you got all that plus monthly retro pay-per-view rundowns from Sandra and I. We just did In Your House, A Cold Day in Hell, which would be a very nice prelude listen to this podcast, if I do say so myself. Also, a bunch of VIP things we do from now and then, like Fave 5 podcast, the podcast we're going to do this week on NXT, where we cover the last kind of few weeks of television. The set of taping since WrestleMania has been getting rave reviews, so we're going to kind of talk about that and get you ready and get you in the mood for TakeOver Chicago. Also, if you go up from there, you get one more thing as part of that $5 level, which I'm going to come back to. For $7, you get all that, plus our classic ITR one a week. But for $50 or more, you can basically choose for us to podcast about any topic that you like. With it, and actually, I do want to say this. Somebody sent me a message or tweet. I can't remember where it was, but I'm sure you're listening to this. And somebody wanted to know if we would talk about Benoit. We would talk about Benoit. I'm happy to talk about Benoit. If you do pick another host who doesn't want to talk about it, we will make sure that at least two of us will. I don't think MD is going to not talk about it. It's just more like you can't really control what people are going to say about it, you know? So that's kind of where we are with Benoit, I think. But it depends what you want. If you want to kind of to talk about the career of Chris Benoit, fair enough. But, you know, if MD tried to be like, can you do a podcast on why Chris Benoit is the greatest of all time? You can't.
Like, or can you do a podcast on why he should be in the Hall of Fame? I'm not going to do a podcast on why he should be in the Hall of Fame. You can't control my opinions. I know people have always, you know, Kenny and David did an Undertaker retrospective, right? And there were a bunch of people that wanted me to do that show. And Alejandro, who requested it, said, you guys choose who you want to do the show. And I didn't feel comfortable doing it because I haven't seen enough of his career to adequately respond. And also, I didn't want to just be a downer, and I don't think it would have been as good as everyone thinks it would have been, right? Because I think it just would have been me being annoyed, and I don't think it would make for a very good podcast. So you can't control our opinions on things. You can't say, like, I'm gonna pledge $50 to make Sandra do a podcast about how much she loves The Undertaker or Randy Orton or something like that. That's not how it works, but we'll cover a topic. And if it's a topic we've already covered, or if it's a topic that we have in the archives that Robert and Kenny have already covered, we can get in touch and either refund you or say, do you have another topic that you want us to talk about? Can we tweak it a little for, you know, added discussion, that kind of thing?
Yeah, 100%. And we've just got two that David and I did today. We've got one on the evolution of wrestling consumption, which is basically Ella had wanted us to do one on fan fiction. It'd be very difficult to just talk about fan fiction exclusively. So we kind of turned it into something where it was like about how wrestling fans consume wrestling and ways in which they can get involved. So that's in there where I end up reading some of Ella's fan fiction about me.
Oh, really?
Good God.
We'll be listening to that after this.
Sandra's still a fan at the end of the day. I am. Me being embarrassed.
I get really excited when you and David record, or like when you and Robert record, because I'm like, yay, I get to listen to Inside the Ropes.
Yeah, I get that once in a blue moon, which I do enjoy. Like,
because I know you're on like almost every show, but we try to give you a break. It's just people have been requesting you specifically, so we can't really.
Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to do it. Like, it's cool. I don't mind doing it. But I remember when Robert and David did the Wrestle Kingdom thing. I was like, oh my god, like I've not heard them. That's cool. So the $50 level. We also did one for Lucy Nevins. It's her birthday today. Happy birthday!
Happy birthday, Lucy.
On ECW One Night Stand 2005, where David and I, very cool, we weren't really expecting this when we went into it, but David's like a hardcore ECW original guy. I'm not really. We talk a little bit about the differences of that. Like, you know, there's a lot of stuff in ECW that I just don't feel comfortable with. And you know I'm super on like the uncomfortable level of stuff usually, but just there's just some stuff that's not for me. And I think that sometimes when you've lived through something, you have a different opinion of it. And you find that here with Retro Raw as well, that there'll be some things that I'm never going to see in a bad light, and Sandra can, because maybe Sandra's not got any emotional attachment to it already.
Right, so, I don't have the nostalgia attached to it. So, I mean, exactly. Whereas, you know, I would be scared to show some people old 2013 NXT because they'd probably be like, this is not that great. I'd be like, yes, it is. Shut up. It's the best ever.
As you strap them into a chair and don't let them leave.
Pretty much.
So we talk about that, and then we kind of talk about why David stopped watching, which kind of relates to ECW a little bit, in 2002. And then we talk, obviously, about the show, One Night Stand. So it's a really interesting 90-minute special. I do just want to say, for people who don't subscribe or pledge, I'm just giving that out there so you know everything that's on offer. Now, you can go up and down any level every month if you want to. Like, you can. So if you go up to $50 because you want us to do a podcast, you obviously can go right back down to like 5 or 1 or 3 or 7 or whatever. Also, if you are somebody who, I've been this way in the past, where like, you know, you work a kind of like flexi job where like sometimes you're like, yay, I'm rolling in the money. And then other times you're like, I need this $2 for food. Like, you can always go down. You can always change it every month if you want to. You can stop for a month. You can come back. You can change it as much as you like. So don't feel you need to come in and do $7 every single month. It's not like that. Also, there's a Patreon app, so you can download it all on your phone. And that's kind of the Patreon. I know I've gone on about it, but I felt like we've not done it in a little while, so at least
we haven't. That's true. And I mean, there's a lot of stuff on there, to be fair. Like, we're always recording stuff for Patreon, as much as we're always recording the weekly shows. It seems like there's just always more and more and more and more, because we've gotten a lot of requests that we're a little bit backed up on right now. And a lot of that is, you know, some of that's down to me because I still need to give Kenny Lucha Underground homework, which I really need to do. And I have not had time to do it. But we're definitely going to get to that. And we're going to get to a lot of the requests, I think, now that WrestleMania season has calmed and before touring starts again, we're going to really make it our goal to get through a lot of these things.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Touring. Great. Bring it on. Mm-hmm. We Sandra and I actually did a special about a week ago on the legacy of Hulkamania.
One of my favorite ones that we've done, actually.
Yeah, we've got really good feedback about that. So please do check that out. Whether you're a Hulk Hogan fan or not, I think it covers both sides of that very well. So
there was someone who tweeted us, and I can't remember who it was, but said that it was like a Christian and an atheist having a discussion. Like, neither could really prove their side, but there was good really chat
annoys,
to be
it
had.
Really annoys me that I know I'm the fucking Christian in that conversation. I know it.
It is kind of actually bizarre.
Anyway. So.
I believe the words blind faith and Hulk Hogan were used, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
I refuse to have my love of Hulk Hogan tarnished by anybody. So if you don't love him, that's fine. Still a good podcast.
No, and it wasn't even used in a derogatory way. It was just to say that, you know, you coming from a fandom of Hulk Hogan and me coming from not a fandom of Hulk Hogan just made for a really interesting discussion. And I think that we did kind of discuss a lot of things about not only his in-ring career, but obviously after his wrestling career and all of the scandals surrounding Hulk Hogan. I think we did a good
public
job
shaming.
On that public
yeah,
shaming.
Yeah, we did a good job. So yeah, please do check it out. So let's go on to talk about now, since we have only spent 29 minutes of the podcast so far not talking about it. You know, the fear is when we do those Patreon plugs, I don't want to become Wade Keller.
Yeah, nor do I.
You know, like Wade Keller's like the, oh my god, I feel like Wade Keller is the podcast equivalent of having 12 pillows in your bed.
Like, I don't actually listen to Wade Keller's podcast, so his plugs don't work very well, apparently. But whenever he's on the Steve Austin show and I listen to it, I fast forward.
That's a shortened version.
About, like, 3 minutes, and then it's usually done. And I know we just talked longer than 3 minutes, but sometimes
The Wade Keller plug on the Steve Austin show is actually about half the length of his usual ones.
Is it seriously? Mm-hmm. Wow.
Anyway, but sometimes we need to bring it up because we've not brought it up in a while, so hopefully that helped. Anyway, it's time to talk about the Raw the night after Cold Day in Hell from Newark, Delaware. I didn't know that was a place.
I didn't know that was a place either.
Not Delaware. I knew Delaware was a place, but like, I didn't know there was a Newark in Delaware.
Yeah, nor did I, but to be fair, I don't know many of the cities in Delaware. Sorry, people who live in Delaware. I'm just not as familiar with your geography.
But at least now we know where the University of Delaware is. It's in Newark.
Yeah, true.
So the show opens with Vince McMahon. And we did forget to say on the Cold Day in Hell podcast, just while I remember, that Vince McMahon, his auntie, Rose Anderson, passed away on the Saturday night. So that's why he missed the pay-per-view. Just so people know.
Didn't they say something? Did they say something at the end of this show or at the end of Cold Day in Hell?
It was the end of Cold Day in Hell.
Okay, because they didn't do like an in memoriam thing at the beginning or anything. They mentioned something like, oh, and just thinking of, you know, this woman who passed away. And it had completely slipped my mind until you just mentioned it right now that, oh, yeah, they did mention something about that. I don't even think it was anything that was in my notes because I just, I don't know, went right over my head because I didn't know who she was.
I do just want to very quickly touch on a couple of notes before this show. Sid had a cortisone block shot in his lower back and was expected to make a return by the end of May. He does not. Also, Vader and Shamrock were kept off this show. Vader was kept off because he was legitimately kind of beaten up after the Shamrock match.
Kicked the shit out of him.
Also, a quite trivia fact, the two, Shamrock and Vader, worked on the match the whole week before the show in Calgary with Bret Hart.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, if you don't love Bret Hart before, he is basically God. That's what we're learning here.
That match was really good. Like, for anyone who didn't listen on Patreon, I'll just tell you, I thought that match was really good.
Mm-hmm. Shamrock is going to be replacing Sid on the next two weekends of house shows, including main event in Madison Square Garden. So, there you go.
Like, I miss Sid, I'm not going to lie. But Ken Shamrock matches over Sid matches? That's kind of an upgrade.
It is, for sure. That's kind of the only notes going into this show. We got Vince McMahon opening the show with kind of like, you know, Ed talking about the events of last night with the stills, as they usually do. And then we get the intro to Raw. It's like, I know I always say it, but like the thing that always grabs me about watching these shows as opposed to today is like there just always seems to be a feeling of chaos right from the beginning. The fans are just, they're so engaged with what's going on. And, like, it's not particularly that the shows are, like, great all the time at all.
They're not.
But it's just, it's interesting to me that the fans are so connected to the show compared to now. And I wonder if that's is that something they could ever get back to? Is it to do with PG? Is it to do with just where culture was in 1997? I don't know.
I think it's probably a mixture of all of that, but also they probably weren't sanitizing the crowds as much as they do now, right? Like, mm-hmm. Nowadays when people try to bring in signs, those signs are definitely censored. Like, you will get your sign taken if you try to be too rowdy or if you try to speak out too much. I mean, they're not going to kick people out for chanting vile shit a lot of the times, when sometimes I'm like, I really don't appreciate some of the chants that happen now. But I feel like culture in 1997, people probably were a little bit more engaged with it because they felt that they were allowed to be. And also, I think some of it could be the detachment that wrestling fans seem to have nowadays because everyone knows everything behind the scenes, right? Like with the internet, I know that in 1997, there was the internet and you could read things like The Observer or things like Power Slam that you subscribe to with Finn Martin, who's going to be part of Inside the Ropes now, which is awesome. But there wasn't this immediate access to everything going on. Like, oh, these guys had a conversation backstage and it wasn't all over Twitter that day. So people watching the show were probably there to more watch the show than criticize the show from a backstage perspective than fans are now. And I'm not necessarily even saying that one is better than the other, but
they're just different.
I think the fandom of wrestling has changed, and it's something that, you know, I get some flack for when I'm just super invested in a story and I'm like, no, I'm just going to be invested in this and I don't care. And I sort of put my blinders on and I'm like, I'm going to watch a story now. And that's something that.
Cause I sometimes wish for you that I could take you to one show from back then.
Mm-hmm.
Just for the crowd engagement level. Like that there was, cause like there would be times when we were in Orlando where you and I would be like, yay. And like, not that many people were around us were doing much.
Especially,
you know?
At TakeOver. Like, our section for TakeOver was just dead. And, you know, I was, like, beside myself because I was at TakeOver. So I'm like, yes! I'm going to be into this if nobody else is. But not that many people around us were, which kind of sucked. I was like, why are you even here?
We need to get better seasons, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
So, we kick off the show with the Hart Foundation. They come out. Brett talks about how great they are. He talks about the fans and their hypocrisy and, you know.
My favorite was when he said, my lovable brother Owen, when he started thanking everyone.
I also loved when he was calling the fans, like, what was he called the fans again? He called them a name. I think he was calling, like, you know, calling them out their hypocrisy. And he was like, you know, people like you. And then, like, the Bulldog pointed to the people as if, like, he's talking about you. Just so you know, and like Bulldog was great.
I mean, he always calls, you know, Americans dirty, stinking hyenas.
That's Steve Austin in this episode, not the crowd.
Oh, Steve Austin, right. Because he does see Stone Cold Steve Austin. Now there's a real hero, this babbling ass full of warmed over Texas cliches with barnyard overtones.
Amazing.
That's when I wrote down.
That's great. So yeah, basically... he tells Undertaker it's just a matter of time till the WWF title comes to the Hart Foundation. He also has a surprise, but he won't tell us what it is yet, so that's just kind of the open.
Well, what I love is that he seems to be about to reveal his surprise, and the fans are chanting, I don't know, were they chanting go home or something? They had been chanting Austin earlier on when Bret Hart was like, what kind of hero would pick on a guy in a wheelchair? And the crowd's like, Austin would pick on a guy in a wheelchair, right? Because that's exactly what he did. And I couldn't tell exactly what the crowd was chanting because sometimes it's just a little hard to pick up audio and I'm not very good at listening to chants. But they were chanting something and Bret was like, I have the biggest surprise. You know what? Whatever. I'm out. And he seemed like he was about to reveal his surprise, but just decided to leave because the fans were reacting to him in exactly the way he needed them to react to him in that situation. He was controlling the crowd perfectly.
Love 97 Bret Hart. He's just one of my favorites.
I mean, everyone who says Bret Hart wasn't good on the microphone, he's pretty good on the microphone, actually. At this point, I know that maybe he wasn't before, but he's certainly taken this and run with it.
Yeah, for sure. But Sondra, it is time for the King of the Ring tournament to begin.
Had no idea this was starting already.
We have the brackets. We're going to get the opening match in the quarterfinals is going to be Hunter Hearst Helmsley versus Ahmed Johnson. We're also going to get Vader versus Crush.
Oh boy. I actually have a picture of the bracket in front of me. Goldust versus King.
That makes sense. It's a, you know, they've got history. Fair enough.
Yeah, ask Vader versus if he's Crush, a sissy though. Man or not.
Vader versus Crush, though. Heel versus heel.
I just don't understand these brackets very well. Well, it's all basically heels, though. Ahmed Johnson and Goldust are the only baby faces on this bracket. Because it's Hunter versus Ahmed, Vader versus Crush, Goldust versus King, and then Savio versus Mankind.
Mm-hmm. I know, that's true.
So there are only two baby faces out of the eight.
It's a very odd bracket. But we kick off with Hunter Hearst Helmsley versus Ahmed Johnson. Hunter Hearst Helmsley is in his element in, you know, a King of the Ring qualifier. China, does this great look to the camera on the way down to the ring, like, fuck off to the camera, which is great. Now, Ahmed Johnson comes out. Is it just me, or is he adding layers of red to his legs?
No, I think he is. I think that he's put, like, pads on the thigh pads or something. I can't figure out exactly what it is, but it seems like there are more layers every time.
Isn't he glorious, though?
I do love him, like, a lot. And flips, I don't know what, ring. Like, there's one point where it's in the match and Triple H is, like, punching him. And Ahmed's looking off to the side, and you can't hear what he says, but it looks like he's just swearing up a storm at the camera, or, like, off camera or something. It mm-hmm. looked like he was saying something obscene. I don't know what exactly, but it looked like he was just going, like, you fucking... Blah, 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 blah. Like, I don't know. He just looks like he's mental and is just yelling or something.
Yeah, absolutely. And then he's so angry because obviously he lost the gauntlet, but, you know, the commentary's trying to kind of save it, so, you know, he's not getting to be ashamed of, and da 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 da.
He couldn't eradicate the Nation of Domination, but it wasn't necessarily his fault. It was the damn numbers game, and also Savio Vega with a chair, softening him up so that Farouk could beat him. It's not like he really stood a chance in this gauntlet if the Nation played it even remotely intelligently, which it turns out they did. So they were the ones that won. Mm-hmm. I did find it interesting when... I think it was JR said, these two men, opposite as they can be, talking about Ahmed and Triple H, we're not talking about race, we're talking about their background. But, like, you kind of are talking about race as well.
Yeah, and Jerry Lawler, what was the line? And I was like, for fuck's sake, he was like...
When he said that Ahmed's family used to pick up Helmsley's garbage, and also he comes from a neighborhood where the most heard words were, you have the right to remain silent.
That's the one.
Eesh. Jeezo, Jerry Lawler, really?
And then JR follows up with, well, Hunter Hearst Helmsley went to a college and Ahmed Johnson was in a gang. You're like, great.
Yeah.
That's backstory. Can we put that in a tale of the tape?
you can tell these two men have no idea how to discuss Ahmed Johnson and the storyline that he's in. They have no idea how to deal with the race politics of what's going on in their own product.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get to that a little bit more with Vince.
Which is great, given that Ahmed Johnson is in a racist storyline with the black man.
Right.
Anyway.
But I'm just saying, the WWF was very ambitious. And again, we'll get to this more with the Vince McMahon interview with Farouk. But it's just, it's interesting that they're presenting the storyline, but they have absolutely no idea what they're doing or even what they're saying.
They're chucking a lot of stuff at the wall, is a way to put it.
They sure are.
Ahmed Johnson gets angry because, you know, he does the spine buster. He basically does that kind of like thing where he jumps up and down. He's going to do the power of a plunge. But China grabs a chair, just nails Ahmed with it in plain mm-hmm. sight of the referee. And then Triple H takes China by the hand, tries to go up the ramp, and then Ahmed runs after him. So Ahmed's like beating the piss out of Hunter. And there's this great bit on the ramp where China goes to kick Ahmed. And Ahmed... it's literally as if a gust of wind went past him. He has no reaction to either of China's kicks. And then China just starts choking him and they sort of fall on top of each other. And then eventually Ahmed kind of gets, you know, breaks free. So Ahmed Johnson has advanced in the 1997 King of the Ring tournament.
Because, of course, like, this does mean that Triple H apparently doesn't value the King of the Ring championship, or not championship, but the tournament very much, because he was willing to get disqualified, or at least China wasn't super concerned with helping him win, because they didn't cheat in a dastardly way so that Triple H could advance. They cheated in a way that he was going to lose the match by disqualification, mm-hmm. but I guess at least he didn't get pinned, so maybe he's more after trying to look dominant in the ring and not actually winning a tournament or something.
Yeah, I think that was, I mean, I guess for China, it was just a case of, well, he's going to lose, may as well hit my chair.
Yeah, well, I mean, Ahmed didn't even hit the Pearl River Plunge, though, before she did it, which is kind of what baffled me a little bit. But I don't know, I still find the commentary around China very fascinating. JR's like, she's a cyborg, and Lawler's like, she's a real woman. And it's like, Lawler's almost sort of more right about something involving a woman, because yes, she's a real woman, like, so are all women.
But to be fair, like, Jerry Lawler is what the pro to his commentary is, that he will defend heels no matter what.
You does call not that matter. A pro. I don't necessarily call that a pro, but you and I have always disagreed on that. Like,
yeah, well, just like, but I think that part of that is shaped on how we both got into wrestling.
That's true.
When you got into wrestling during the awful 3 to 4 man booths that were around, but luckily in NXT,
I got into wrestling when the coal mine was going to be a thing.
Yes, yes. Which, you know, great storyline, not great for commentary.
No.
But yeah, because it used to be you had a commentator who went for the bad guys, commentator who went for the good guys, and that was kind of, you know, it was like a formula that worked. And I think that what works about it here is that Jerry Lawler is just a completely insufferable person. That is, well, I mean, he's funny as well sometimes. I can't say he's not. But I think with Jerry Lawler, the funny thing is, like, I think it was last week or it was at the pay-per-view where he was defending the Hart Foundation and somebody was like, oh, what about all that stuff you said about Stu Hart? And he's like, listen, don't go there. Don't be bringing things up.
I'm like, okay. Well, that's the funny part is when they call Jerry Lawler out on, you know, now that he's supporting Bret Hart, you know, and you can tell he doesn't want to say anything nice about Stu and Helen, but he's always been so in support of Owen Hart. And now that Bret Hart is also a heel, Jerry Lawler's like, yeah, Bret's great now. And they call him out on it, to be fair. JR will call him out and say, like, you hated Bret Hart. What even are you doing? Lawler's just like, no, whatever. I don't want to talk about it.
Pretty much. We do get a graphic at the beginning of the show for two matches. The Undertaker versus Savio Vega. Oh, good God.
Oh, boy.
And LOD versus the Nation of Domination. We don't know who we're getting yet, but we will get to that. Up next is an interview with Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Mention that the King of the Ring is presented by Super Soaker, which I love Super Soakers. Like, I had a Super Soaker as a child, and their motto, wetter is better, made me laugh like a juvenile, like 12-year-old boy.
That's almost as good as the APA used to have a t-shirt that was called, that said, always pounding ass.
I shouldn't laugh as much as I do, but it just made me laugh.
But Steve Austin comes out. You know, obviously, it's a very important night for him. Like, he's just lost the match for the WWF Championship. How's he feel? And he's still got Bret's crutch, which he's carrying around like a trophy. And it's funny, you see a lot of shots. Yeah, you see a lot of shots of the crowd, and you can see a lot of people seem to relate to Austin. Mm-hmm. You know, like, they seem to... No, I don't want to say live vicariously to them, that's a bit too far, but, like, you can tell that they definitely, I feel like there's an engagement with him that you don't see as much with, like, a Shawn Michaels. Like, the fans who like Shawn Michaels, like, they like him, but you don't feel like they're, like, you know, living through him. But I feel like with Steve Austin, he's got far more of that already, and we're not even anywhere near his huge ascension to the top.
Yeah, no, that's accurate. I mean, I would say that the people that like Shawn Michaels admire him from afar as, like, a pretty boy or someone who can wrestle very well, but it's not someone that you would think that you could be, maybe. And Steve Austin mm-hmm. just seems like a guy from Texas who's pissed off.
Yeah, and, you know, that's, like, even at the beginning he says he's not gonna, you know, bitch about the fact that he didn't win last night. He has a good line about saying that he carried Brian Pillman in, like, I can't remember what the word was, like, rinky dink promotions or something, or, like, basically Slayton WCW.
Mm-hmm. When Vince McMahon says, you know, last night was one hell of a match, and Austin's even like, the last thing I need is you sucking up to me because I'll knock your head off your damn neck.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, he tells Brett, if you want to come get your crutch, come try and get it off me. And he says that it's all leading up to the Pillman thing here. And he said he was crippled him once before and carried him in his back pocket. I think it was the Bush Leagues he called it, actually. Mm-hmm. Bush Leagues or Rinky Dink. Anyway, and he says, but when they finally get it on, Stone Cold's going to destroy him. And that's the bottom line because Stone Cold said so. And there's just this great visual of him, like, doing his pose on the second rope with the crutch, which I just loved.
It's really good.
I love he's just carrying it around like a big prop.
I'm also just fascinated by the Austin McMahon dynamic at this point, because
it gets so much more fascinating. Because see, for a few months when they get going, and I think this just says that when I was a kid, I was far too proper or, like, not. Anyway, like, I was on Vince's side for a while.
Well, I still think Vince comes across as the babyface here. And you know how I feel about Vince a little bit later on when he tries to come across as a babyface and say, what, like 2001 or so? I don't think he does at all. But I think here, Austin is still definitely coming across as a heel. He's coming across as a cool heel, but he's not coming across as a babyface in any way, shape, or form. And I continue to stand by that.
But obviously they are booking him. I don't want to use the word. They are booking him like a babyface. You know, he's being booked against heels and everybody loves him. So he's acting like a heel within the confines of being booked like a babyface.
He's like Roman Reigns. Which is very
bizarre. No, he's not.
No,
no, he's not.
In the sense that right, Roman Reigns comes across as a heel, but is supposed to be a babyface. It's different because in this instance, the fans are actually cheering Austin. And the fans sort of like...
I feel like the difference is that here, what's happening is a deliberate effort by a company. That like the WWE...
Oh, it's absolutely deliberate here. And it's deliberate to an opposite degree with Roman Reigns. But I'm just saying that in terms of character, in terms of how they're being booked to react and how they're being booked to face opponents, I think it's actually kind of similar in the fact that they're like... They're not booked to be good or bad guys. You're supposed to cheer them, or in Roman's case, I feel like you're kind of supposed to boo him, even though they're presenting him as a face, but you're still kind of supposed to boo him. But they're not supposed to be traditional good or bad guys.
Yeah, and I guess the big difference, though, you know, you're right, but I guess the big difference is that I feel like in this situation with Austin, WWF are very in control of what's happening. And they are, you know, they're in control of how the fans are reacting. That's a large part to do with how good Austin is and how good Brett is. They're pulling that off all the time. But I think the difference with today is that, you know, it's been a couple of years now of them constantly wanting reactions they're not getting. Whereas here, you know, we're getting to see this really organic rise of someone. And like, when was the last time that Steve Austin had a bad week? I mean... I mean, can't remember.
Gun week wasn't the greatest week, but that wasn't necessarily due to him having a bad performance. That was due to Vince McMahon not calling the police.
Yeah, but yeah, and Kevin Kelly and his absolute gangster reporting style.
Exactly.
Of just not giving three fucks. He's fucking getting that report.
And the unnamed cameramen who were right there in the action too.
Could have been killed. But like... That's the point, is like, you know, we've been watching this with Steve Austin, so he started doing promos on Bret Hart in October. We're now in May. He's been continuously killing it for all that time. And I think that's the difference between like kind of today's product, I guess, in some ways, and back here, is that we're seeing the organic rise of somebody. And it's just continuing and continuing and continuing.
Well, and I think maybe one of the differences is, too, is that we're seeing the organic rise of somebody and they're willing to go with it. And yeah, some of that has to do with injuries to other people that have happened. But Steve Austin was not the plan, right? Like, even when he won King of the Ring 96, which we didn't cover here on Retro Raw because it was before our timeline started. But that was not the plan. The plan was for Triple H to win. And Steve Austin versus Bret Hart was not the plan for WrestleMania. Bret Hart versus Shawn Michaels was the plan for WrestleMania. But as Bret Hart said in his promo, Shawn Michaels was like afraid to face him. Or I think he says it later in the show when he talks to Shawn Michaels during that segment, which happens on this show, right? Like, I've been waiting for this to happen. But with Austin, he was never the plan to be the guy, but the fans seem to be getting behind him. And it seems like they're more willing to strike a balance between fan reaction and their plans, right?
But isn't it funny, though, that the whole time here, and you're right, you've hit the nail on the head that he was never the plan. Even when he wasn't the plan and he was the secondary guy, he was still booked far better than the planned guy today.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of how they present him. And I think a large part of what it's got to do with as well is something you brought up earlier on, is the way that people consume wrestling now. Because when you watched in 1997, unless you really, like... Basically, subscribe to The Observer is pretty much the only way, but like, you didn't know. I mean, like, see if I was watching this and I didn't know the stuff that we've talked about, I would have thought Steve Austin was always the plan.
Like, oh, because it seems like he is. Because he seems like the way more compelling story, right? Like, when Shawn Michaels comes out later and, you know, Shawn and Bret have their interaction and all of that, like, I knew that was going to happen, but it still seems secondary to Steve Austin versus the Hart Foundation, because that seems like the most compelling story on the show. And so the fact that Steve Austin is going to go after Brian Pillman first, because as he calls him the snake's ass, he's like, if there's a snake's ass to the machine of the Hart Foundation, it's Brian Pillman, which I don't know, that line just made me laugh for some reason. But oh boy, do I want to see Austin versus Pillman, but it seems like we're still getting to Austin versus Brett someday, because that seems like the bigger story. Shawn Michaels mm-hmm. has always felt a little secondary. Steve Austin versus The Undertaker at Cold Day in Hell felt very secondary. You know, the video package at the beginning of Cold Day in Hell tried as it might, but it really didn't feel like Steve Austin versus Undertaker was ever the main story. Steve Austin going after the belt is the main story, but Steve Austin versus the Hart Foundation seems to be the big thing going forward, and it seems like that's on his way to the top to get the belt someday. And I don't know when he first wins the belt. I have a guess, but I'm not sure. And I know, I'm pretty sure it's not soon. So I just find this all really interesting with the little bits of knowledge and the scenes that I know on the way to Montreal, especially because the Brett Shawn dynamic is something that I'm very familiar with, because it's something that everyone's very familiar with, right? Like, how mm-hmm. often do people talk about Survivor Series 97? It's very
interesting. You kind of can't be a fan without that coming up a million times.
Exactly. And so it's fascinating in this whole Retro Raw journey, I guess, for me, that when certain scenes actually happen on Retro Raw, like the one at the end of this episode, I'm like, mm-hmm. oh, this is when this happens. Okay. And kind of like putting the puzzle pieces together. But if mm-hmm. I'm just watching Raw in a line without knowing what's going to happen, I would say Steve and Brett are absolutely the main story. But I know that it's not.
Another big story, though, Sandra, is we have a debut come out.
We sure do.
Son of Ivan Putski, the Hall of Famer, Scott Putski, is making his debut against Leif Cassidy. Scott Putski with the most boring entrance theme I've ever heard.
Big Scott, look at his hair. It's majestic.
So he has a match against Leif Cassidy, aka Arsenal, and he beats him in 4 minutes with a sort of a German suplex, I guess.
Kenny, Scott Putski is amazing. Did you know he played football at the Texas Christian University for the Horned Frogs?
Let me think of places I never need to go. Number 4 on the list. The Texas Christian University.
I mean, that was one of their main talking points. He played for the Horned Frogs at Texas Christian University.
Going to the Texas Christian University means I need to hang out with Christians, no offense. And I also need to hang out with Scott fucking Putski. Jesus. Anyway.
It also reminded me, just somewhere in this match, where's Tiger Ali Singh at this point?
Because, I mean, that's a question you're going to ask for the next 4 years, because he's never a regular character.
Because I feel like we had a press conference and then another press conference for Tiger Ali Singh. And he was supposed to be a big, son of a Hall of Fame level guy. Big debut. He's going to be amazing. And we just haven't seen him, at all.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be honest, I think Scott Putski in the ring at this point is better than Rocky Maivia.
Interesting. I think he had a good first match. He then, at the end, is clearly waiting around for some reason, and we don't know why until Leif Cassidy leaps out of the ring and attacks him. And then Putski leaves, and Leif Cassidy starts yelling at JR that he won, and JR's like, "You didn't win. Go back to the showers." And then Cassidy's like, "I did win!" And he's like, "Okay." And then as he leaves, he goes, "He didn't win. He's an idiot."
Yeah. Which was kind of great, actually. I liked it. I liked Leif Cassidy at the end of this reacting to his loss, because reacting to loss is one of my favorite things. And, you know, him just being like, "No, I won, I promise." Even though Scott Putski definitely beat him with that released German suplex and it was super anticlimactic. But Leif Cassidy, grabbing JR, he didn't just yell at JR. He, jumped onto the announce table and was, grabbing JR by the collar, going, "No, da 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 da, I swear I won and I'm amazing." And JR's like, "You are delusional." And it's fascinating knowing that he turns into Al Snow, because Al Snow, right? But I don't know. I kind of like Leif Cassidy. I got really excited to see Leif Cassidy again. I've missed him.
He is, at this point, handed in his release.
Has he?
Yeah.
So it's going to be a while until I see him again, isn't it?
No, you still see him for a few more months, but he needs to leave soon so he can go away and become Al Snow.
Okay.
We get LOD against the Nation of Domination, but the Nation of Domination members that we get is PG-13. So it's JC Ice and Wolfie D, which is really hard for me to say without starting to do the Nation of Domination rap.
Oh, it was Wolfie D? I thought it was Wolfie D. I was so confused because they were saying the names, and I was like, what even are their names? And also JC Ice? JC Ice is the one who dances and has the hair and is definitely
And is the son
favorite.
Of Bill Dundee.
He is?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That just blew my mind a little bit. Sorry. That was amazing. I don't even know what to do with that information. The son of Bill Dundee is rapping with a mohawk and his name is JC Ice?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I mean, I was into it when both of them managed to, like, pile drive Hawk, and I was rooting for the Nation Rappers. I kind of like the Nation Rappers. They make me laugh a little bit, but they get pinned pretty quickly after the Legion of Doom hit that finisher that I can never remember the name of. And I don't understand the logic behind putting the Rappers in this match. Was, like, were they just trying to fuck with the Legion of Doom or something? Because it was clearly the Legion of Doom were going to win. Like, why are you sending the Rappers out? That makes the Nation of Domination look kind of like crap.
This is the last time you see PG-13.
Really?
That's what it was. They were getting rid of them.
No. So the Nation was trying to get rid of the Rappers, and this was like them feeding them to the hawk and the animal. That makes me so sad. They're my favorite.
But here's the thing, Sandra. Bit of story time.
Okay.
When you're a black man who is beginning a gimmick about how racist white people are, it is hard to have two white rappers in your group.
What are they going to do about Crush?
But he's black and on the inside.
For fuck's sake.
And Savio Vega's a half and half, so, you know, it works.
I mean, Savio Vega's Latino, but, like, what even? I'm gonna miss the Rappers, for sure.
So, yeah, they get beaten very
They're
easily.
They're left in a mass of humanity.
I cannot describe to you how much JC Ice's wrestling gear offends me. Cum-stained three-quarter-length jeans are not a way to endear me to you.
I mean, tell that to Enzo Amore.
Anyway, before we get Mankind, though, we have one more reality check that we need to get through. So we cut to this lady in her bedroom, and she is wearing some sort of, like, red negligee robe thing, and she's talking about her husband, who is a very, very large man, and he's not trying anymore in the relationship. He won't pump her. Like, he does what I think is, like, dry humping to her arse at one point in the bed. Mm-hmm. She's just not up for it. He's, like, eating cereal like he's fucking molesting it. It's not good. But then he starts, like, getting a wee bit of mojo about him, and you're like, not the bad mojo, but, like, you know.
The Raleigh variety. The sexy boy variety.
And then he begins singing Sexy Boy to his wife. And she's kind of half into it. She's getting there. And then
maybe he should have pierced his navel to get her all the way there.
But then he danced to Sexy Boy.
His tits were swinging.
And she was all about it. So basically, he danced to Shawn Michaels' song, and that allowed him to fuck his wife. So Shawn Michaels is helping married couples now.
What I have written down about this reality check.
I cannot wait, because usually what Sandra does, if you've not listened to this before, I'm sure you have, but every week Sandra is baffled by the reality checks. Baffled by them.
I am
so excited as to how you feel about this one. Please,
I don't want this to be reality. Okay. Lara and husband don't have sex anymore, but lately this fat man with tits sings to Sexy Boy, and I am terrified and don't want this to be a reality check. Please help.
Shawn Michaels is essentially a marriage counselor at this point.
Maybe that should be his new gimmick, actually.
Amen.
Can you even imagine? That could be incredible. I mean, it would be terrible, but it would be incredible in the way that I would fall in love with it. It'd be a lot better than him just talking about his belly button ring being why I don't like him. No, I don't like you because you're a cunt. Now fuck off.
Look out for that Inside the Ropes tour with Shawn Michaels where Sandra's manning his cue.
I'm not saying now necessarily, but I'm saying in 1997, he did not come across as the most pleasant person.
Mm-hmm. So then Mankind comes out. He wants to bring it his Uncle Paul, who's obviously deformed from the, you know, the fireball at Revenge of the Taker. So Paul Bettany comes out in like a mummy mask, essentially.
Well, I mean, his face is just wrapped in bandages, basically. I like that Mankind started out the promo with 4 score and several weeks ago, I brought forth to the Undertaker a great wall of flames, and goes on in that sort of style. I love Mankind's promos are so much better than Mankind's matches.
Yep, I'm with you. I'm with you. But he does bring in Uncle Paul, and Uncle Paul, you know, demands the cameraman, you know, puts the camera near his face that's so disfigured, which again, you know, as we know, wrestling is emotional scarring.
I assume that Uncle Paul is going to have the same genetic defect or superhero healing powers as the Undertaker and Kane, and that these scars will be emotional.
You would be correct. He does, however, say he's going to give the Undertaker one more chance to make amends, because there's a secret that he has that he's vowed to keep while standing over the gravesite of Undertaker's parents. But Undertaker's got this one last chance, or Paul Bearer's going to hurt him bad. And Mankind and Paul embrace.
I mean, Mankind's all like, no more chances, Uncle Paul. But Paul Bearer's like, if you do not accept this final offer, I'm going to do something that only you know, Undertaker. I will reveal it to the whole world. And, you know, the whole graveside thing. And I just wrote, holy shit, it's going to be Kane. It's starting.
Yeah.
I'm so excited. Mm-hmm.
This is legitimately a great storyline. Really great storyline.
When I say I'm so excited, I mean I am genuinely so excited about this storyline. And I, last week, was ready for the Undertaker and Mankind to be done. I think I said that on the In Your House Cold Day in Hell review on Patreon. I was just like, I mean, they've been fighting the whole time that we've been doing Retro Raw. And I am for long feuds, but they've been fighting the whole time. And
I said this on the Patreon podcast. I was saying what's funny is that Sondra came into this after they'd had their original run of matches.
Right, so they've been doing this for over a year now?
So then up next we get Farouk coming out for a promo. He is now the number one contender for the World Wrestling Federation Championship. He's going to be going on to face the Undertaker. Because he defeated Ahmed Johnson and stopped Ahmed from winning the gauntlet.
Like a number one contendership match or anything. And I mean, he stopped Ahmed from winning the gauntlet in not the most impressive fashion.
But Sondra, sometimes, you know, you're looking at the roster and you're going, right, okay, so who's Gorilla Monsoon going to give a match to the Undertaker? Is he going to give it to Vader? No, he lost to Ken Shamrock. Is he going to give it to Mankind? No. He's been beaten 100 times with the Undertaker. Is he going to give it to Bret Hart? No, he's injured. Is he going to give it to Shawn Michaels? No, he's injured. Is he going to give it to Steve Austin? Just lost. But who won at Cold Day in Hell? Farouk.
I mean, I guess Farouk did get a win.
Maybe if you were open and weren't being such an Uncle Tom about this, maybe, Sondra, if you were more open-minded to diversity.
Don't get me wrong. I'm all for Farouk versus The Undertaker at this point. Why not Farouk versus The Undertaker? Sure.
So Farouk comes out in what I think needs to be stated is one of the top five outfits of the Retro Raw run so far. Let's be honest.
It's quite good.
Yeah, it works. And he comes out and, you know, Vince is sort of saying, you know, you're the number one contender, blah, blah. How do you feel about it? And then Farouk's like, you know, you've had number one contenders out here before, but you've never had a black guy. You know, you've had your black guys be like Intercontinental Champion like Ahmed Johnson or US Champion like Bobo Brazil. And, you know, the reason that it's never happened is because you don't think a black man is worthy of being the WWF champion. It's okay for him to raise your kids and drive your cars and shine your shoes, but, you know, you won't let him win a title, and that's the old times. But now, you know, he wants to be there for the little, you know, the little black kids at home who don't think they have a place. And it's like, so Farouk's basically cutting a really impassioned babyface promo.
That's
here.
That's exactly how I took this when he was talking about, like,
and then
yeah.
Vince McMahon's just like, come on, you're a bit racist. I'm like,
Vince McMahon, actually, this is something I really wanted to bring up. Vince says the words, "Don't you feel those comments are racist?" Oh boy. Oh boy, Vince McMahon. Do you not understand what you're doing here? I love the fact that WWF is going here with the storyline, right? And I know this is one of David J. McCutcheon's favorite things in the history of wrestling is the Nation of Domination and their commentary on race and, you know, calling out some of the really, like, very politically charged race relation issues that were going on in the mid-90s that still are going on now today. Obviously, like, some of these issues are still incredibly relevant. And, I mean, Farouk mentioning the fact that, you know, yeah, you've had token blacks in positions like Ahmed Johnson or like Bobo Brazil basically to tide us over and make us feel like we were good enough. But, you know, when's the last time a black man had a chance to fight for the title? He's totally right. When's the last time a black man had a chance to fight for the title?
He asked, the first question he asked Vince McMahon was, when was the last time a black man held WWF Championship? And Vince went, never.
Right.
But you know, the thing is, if you want to get into race relations here, if you really want to go into it, it's not like the WWF had multiple guys who people were like, they should have been world champion.
They don't, but I think that that's part of the problem. And I think that that's part of the problem that Farouk is bringing up. Maybe not with, you know, maybe that's not what they're meaning to say, but I think that's part of the problem as you examine it, right? Like, why weren't there more black wrestlers? Why weren't there more black wrestlers that you felt were worthy of being in our organization? Why weren't there more black wrestlers that you felt were worth pushing as stars? And I think that's part of the conversation. And I know that this is the mid-90s and those types of conversations.
This is 5 years after Tony Atlas portrayed Saba Simba.
Right.
And it's what's interesting is I've just finished watching for like the third time The People versus O.J. Simpson, because it's such a great show. And like, I just finished
it. Alaric watched it, but I haven't.
It's so good.
I need to.
Anyway, you do. I'll send you links. But like, I've just finished watching it, and, you know, the whole, that's obviously very racially charged. And then I'm watching this Farouk promo and I'm just kind of like, yeah, fucking go for it, Farouk. On you go. And
well, and then, I mean, Vince McMahon just put me off and he was like, don't you feel that your comments are racist? And that gets into the whole reverse racism thing, right? Like, oh, you're being racist to white people right now. Fuck right off. Thank you. No.
I mean, I don't think like Vince McMahon's been like Mark Furman here or anything, which People vs. O.J. Simpson reference. Well, basically, you know, Mark Furman's the famous police officer who found the glove of O.J. Simpson.
Right, right.
But he also was a very big racist. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that wasn't helpful. But I thought Farouk did a great promo here.
Well, and talking about little black boys and little black girls sitting at home feeling the pain right now. I mean, Farouk, would that face turn in my mind is what I actually have written down in my notes, because I'm like, no, that's a really important point. Like, who do little black
call the Undertaker the white savior?
Yeah.
The white savior, which is great because, like, I feel like Undertaker backstage would be like looking around going like, you know, in the locker room with Bob Holly going, man, I never call myself the white savior. I never.
No.
I said I was the dead man. I didn't say it was. But, and then, you know, at the end, he does have this great bit where he says, you know, he's going to, at King of the Ring, Undertaker will be a dead man. I thought it was a really good line to finish. Mm-hmm. Farouk here, like, you know, Ron Simmons, I think, you know, people say, oh, he was the first, you know, first African-American world champion. And he was, but he was a Bob Backlund level. He wasn't like, you know, he just wasn't like a huge name. But I think that the best stuff he ever did in his career is now, this next 6 months.
Well, this promo because Nation of Domination has been kind of intriguing, but it seems like they haven't really wanted to go there with race.
They've been half-pregnant.
Yeah, they have been, and they've been saying, you know, by any means necessary, and they've been using some racially charged language, and they've been calling Ahmed Johnson Uncle Tom. But Farouk, I don't know if before this has actually called out the fact that, you know, like, when was the last time a black man won a championship? And he actually, like, put out there, he's like, this is what I face as a black wrestler in your organization. The fact that he's giving this interview to Vince McMahon is very interesting to me, because we all know at this point, because after fake Razor and Diesel and JR's, you know, quote unquote heel turn or whatever, we know that Vince McMahon owns the company. So the fact that he's giving this promo to Vince McMahon saying, when's the last time you let someone challenge for a championship? I find it really interesting. And I feel like this promo stepped up my interest in Farouk like 10 times. Because the Nation of Domination has been kind of cool and interesting, but they've just been fighting Ahmed Johnson, and I'm not super sure what their goals are. I'm not super sure what they're trying to accomplish by any means necessary, other than creating the, you know, quote unquote Nation of Farouk. But they're actually getting into it here, and I really mm-hmm. like it. But also, they're totally good. Not heels. with this ideology. This ideology is not a heel ideology.
It's a flawed ideology if you really want it to be a heel. We then go into The Undertaker versus Savio Vega. Savio Vega fills me with dread every time he wrestles.
They show a bunch of white people booing the Nation of Domination. And did you notice, there's one shot that I noticed in particular, that there's a little boy who's black and he's booing too, right? He's booing Savio because boo Savio Vega, you're heel. You know, the Nation of Domination has done dastardly things, especially to Ahmed Johnson. So I can see why everyone would boo the Nation of Domination at this point, right? Like, they're despicable heels. There's this little black boy and he's booing the Nation of Domination and they pan over to this white dude who's saying that the Nation sucks. And I just thought that that camera angle was really, really interesting considering the race politics that they're bringing up on their show, that they would like pan over from the little black boy to be like, no, but here's what this white guy has to say. And I know it's just one camera angle, but I don't know. I found it fascinating just in the presentation of it.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's very interesting how they do this angle because, you know, for what people say, WWF never really get the cusp of what's going on in society. You know, they're really tapping into something here. So
I don't even know if they know what they're tapping into.
Well, also because, yeah, I mean, the problem is, like, The Undertaker as a character, you know, as a babyface, you know, it's not like he is being an arsehole. So the problem is, like, Undertaker is just like, you know, moseying on down with his title reign, is now being called the White Savior against the guy who's like, I'm doing it for all the black kids.
You're right.
Like, right. Quite tough for me to get babyface reaction at this point.
The Undertaker's like, dude, I'm supposed to be a zombie. Like, what?
And I feel really bad, like, because Undertaker, you know, has this good match with Steve Austin the night before, and it's like, oh no, now it's him and Savio. So, you know, their match is exactly what you would imagine an Undertaker and a Savio Vega match would be.
I will say, and this is, you know, rare for me, good on the Undertaker selling his leg. And good on Savio Vega going after the injured leg. I kind of liked the story of their match. It wasn't the most compelling match. It wasn't something I was going to watch over and over again. Nope. But I thought they told a good story, and it showed that the Undertaker did actually sustain damage from the Steve Austin match last night.
Which is good. We like continuity. Undertaker goes to the choke slam, and he's about to get the finish. He takes out Crush and D'Lo Brown, who got on the apron. Hits the Tombstone and Savio, but the Nation of Domination all jump in, and it's the DQ. And then once Undertaker's getting beaten down, Farouk whips him with a leather strap and then holds up the WWF title, which I thought was so interesting that, like, we have this promo, which is like a babyface kind of promo, and then Farouk gets his gang to beat up the White Savior, and then he whips the White Savior and holds up the title. Very, very good stuff. So
it's fascinating. I mean, JR is like, the WWF title has never been about race. This is now very personal. And it still doesn't necessarily feel personal to me because I don't feel like Undertaker really has a stake in it. I feel like Undertaker's just there by virtue of being champion. And that's not a dig at the Undertaker. It's just I don't feel like the Nation has anything personally against the Undertaker. It's not like the Nation were the ones who attacked Paul Bearer, right? Or, well, I mean, Paul Bearer's not with him. The Undertaker attacked Paul Bearer. But, like, but do you
also
know what
it's not like? Well, it's not like Farouk. It's not like we've been watching Farouk for 3 months going, ah, Farouk's clearly in, you know, going towards this match with Undertaker, because he wasn't the original opponent, so it's like another kind of secondary story that's coming in.
I feel like it's one of those situations where they tell us this is very personal, and it's not yet, but it could maybe get there.
Yeah, and then, you know, Karan had said it on the Facebook community last week, which is interesting, is that another example of different feuds. You know, in one part of the show, you got Paul Bearer saying, Undertaker, I've got a secret, you better not do anything, and then Undertaker's feuding with the Nation as well. You've got Steve Austin, who's feuding with Brian Pillman and the Hart Foundation. I know they're the same thing, but, you know, it's like multiple people are feuding with multiple people, and it's cool.
Well, and I like that there are different alliances that kind of help those story threads work, because it makes it seem like the show is interconnected and that there's a lot going on, but anyone could kind of face anyone and have some sort of personal disagreement. Honestly, Farouk and The Undertaker are two who really haven't had any disagreements whatsoever. So it's kind of the two that are most polar opposite and disconnected in the world of Raw at this point. So, but I mean, Undertaker has the belt, and the belt is the thing that can always kind of bring feuds together. So I like that everything's kind of interconnected right now. That does make it more interesting.
We then cut to Rob Van Dam comes out
to ECW. Hardy.
Now, my memories of Rob Van Dam currently are that he charges too much for booking fees, but also that he, sorry, did I say that out loud?
you did.
And, should not drink while I do this.
Should I edit that out?
No, that's fine.
Okay.
Who cares? But I really loved Rob Van Dam back in the day. I always thought he was much bigger than he was given a role and stuff. But you know, he is that guy who came back and now looks quite old in the face and still has the hair from when he was younger. My God, he was fresh faced here.
Oh, he looks like baby Rob Van Dam. He's so cute.
Rob Van Dam.
I just did not expect this at all. Like, I heard the ECW music, right? And I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, ECW again. Because I'm sorry to all of you ECW fans, but every time ECW has come to Raw, it's just been kind of terrible and not very interesting to me. Because I didn't watch ECW, so I don't have a connection to these characters. But then I heard from Battle Creek, Michigan, and I was like, wait, what? Oh, wait, Rob Van Dam is here. That's interesting. And then across the ring from Rob Van Dam, oh, wait, what? Versus a young baby jobber Jeff Hardy, you say? This match is way more interesting watching it in 2017 than it would have been first off in 1997 when no one, you know, if you didn't watch ECW, you didn't know who Rob Van Dam was. This is his first Raw appearance, right?
Yeah, yeah, first Raw appearance for old RVD.
For old RVD. He's already doing the pointing. I hate the pointing. I hate it so much. I hate little it Jeff almost as much as I... Little baby Jeff, little Jeff Hardy, he's so
He bought a little outfit, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. It was so cute. I mean, we've seen the Hardy Boys once before, but this is not a match I expected to see, and it's not like it's anything that is a match that blows you away, but it's just kind of fascinating watching it back and not expecting this to happen right now, because I didn't think RVD was in WWF for a while, but apparently he is now. And then Lawler comes to the ring to, of course, say extremely crappy wrestling, because that seems to be his favorite thing to say about ECW. He even said it very recently because he can't get over the past. And, you know, he's found Rob Van Dam. So Lawler's the one bringing in Rob Van Dam, who I didn't even realize came into WWF as a heel, which is kind of fascinating to me, because Lawler's bringing him in to talk about how bad ECW is. And then RVD badly talks about how bad ECW is, because Rob Van Dam cannot cut a promo here at all. He is terrible. But this is where Lawler names him Mr. Monday Night. I didn't realize this happened so early on. I was guessing it happened like 99 or 2000 or something.
Yeah, no, because this is kind of around the time period where, you know, Lawler's going to ECW and different stuff. But, you know, it's just a squash match, really, for RVD. But, you know, RVD does give Jeff, you know, some offense a little bit.
Jeff got a little bit of offense. He got to jump on him.
Lawler calls Jeff Hardy a John Bon Jovi wannabe, which in 1997 was a decent reference.
He did have the headband and everything.
He did. But yeah, so Rob Van Dam wins the match in like a couple of minutes, and that's her new storyline, is RVD's with Jerry Lawler.
I thought it was really interesting that the frog splash was not his finisher.
Yeah, he decided to do more.
He did the split leg moonsault instead on Jeff Hardy, against a jobber, no less. So, I mean, Jeff Hardy got more offense than you would expect for, you know, some guy debuting and wanting to bring him in and show how great he is. I mean, the match was, it went a few minutes. It wasn't like a 1 minute match. And it was actually pretty good. It was better than most Rob Van Dam matches that I've seen probably in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Because my memories of Rob Van Dam coming back in 2013 are that he had a pregnant gut, and I hate with everything in my being. I'm with Robert on this one. I do not like Rolling Thunder. I don't like it at all. Why would you do a forward roll before doing a standing splash? I just don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, it's 3:30 in the morning, so that's another conversation I think I could get into, but I'm gonna move on.
Let me remind everybody that tonight on USA, Nikita poses as the long-lost daughter of a nuclear terrorist.
I was so going to write that down because I remembered it. I was just like, oh my God. Jim Ross hates
having to promote La Femme Nikita, and it is the best.
So up next, we get part two of the sit-down interview with Dustin Runnels and Terry. Obviously, it is not anywhere near as newsworthy as it was last week. But the basic gist of the story is, you know, he wants to make his dad proud. And What did you think of this week's one?
This week, I actually kind of felt for Dustin Runnels again. I think because he wasn't saying things like, I know exactly how Ellen feels, and I had to come out in a different way, and trying to compare his plight to the plight of gay people, just to capitalize on the popularity of a television show where a character outed herself as gay. I did kind of feel for him here because, I mean, first of all, you have Lawler going, is he a man or is he a sissy? I thought he was trying to tell the world he wasn't a sissy, but nah. Like, fuck off, Lawler. I hate you. But
Jim Ross says he's a real man.
Right. Mm-hmm. Sure. So,
I love that you hate the idea of someone being called a real man. What does that mean?
I hate it so much. Like, I hate it so much, Kenny. You know that this bothers me. But I thought it was fascinating that Dustin is, talking about having to still do this character to entertain the people because he has to take care of his family. And he wants people to remember his matches and say, if they go and see a show, I want them to say that Goldust, he was really entertaining. This feels very out of its time because it seemed like the kind of commentary that people nowadays really criticize wrestlers for, right? Like criticizing wrestlers for saying, I want to have the best match or I want to have the most entertaining match. Like you should want to win. And Goldust here in 1997 is having that exact conversation. I want to be the most entertaining and I want people to say that, that Goldust entertained me. And I didn't expect to see this kind of conversation in 1997. So I just thought that was really interesting. But then he goes on to talk about his daughter, Dakota, who's 3 at this point, which is just so sweet. And talks about, her watching him in the crowd and looking up to him. And then he gets into, seeking his own father's approval. And I guess my question for you, was Dusty in WCW at this point? What was he doing?
Yes, Dusty was in WCW as a commentator at this point.
Because,
Dave Meltzer had written in the Observer about, because obviously I guess at that point he's getting constant questions about is Dusty Rhodes coming in or whatever.
Right, because it seems like that's what they're leading to.
But Dusty at this point still had another year on his WCW contract, but apparently the WWF were very aware that doing this would provoke rumors of Dusty, which probably they probably wanted the rumors because it would get people to tune into the show, So
I assume that was the point of it. It was just, it felt very somber. Whereas last week, I feel like the first part of the interview was good. And then the rest of it was like, oh, for fuck's sake, will you please stop just being offensive?
Well, because the thing is, like, what they're doing here is, you've got like, Sid, who is not there anymore. And, you've got the whole Hart Foundation. And there's not really a lot of baby faces to be kind of on that other side. And you've got, so the heel side, you've got the Nation of Domination, you've got the Hart Foundation, you've got the Hunter Hearst Helmsley, you've got Vader, you've got all these heels, and there's not many baby faces. So I think the idea is kind of just to try and shine something onto Goldust, that because he's kind of in this weird position, right, where he the original gimmick was him being sort of
playing homosexual.
Well, initially it was being sort of homosexually provocative, and then it was homophobic. And well, he was never really homophobic, but there was moments.
I feel like the manufactured reaction to him played on the homophobia of society.
Yeah, that's fair. But then when he does the thing where Jerry Lawler is like, are you queer? And he's like, no. And he's with Marlena, and then there's stuff.
Yeah, you're not queer. We can cheer you now. Like, this made him a much more compelling babyface than, yay, he's not queer, I can cheer him now, for sure, because he's a guy who wants to be like his dad and wants to entertain people. I felt like he actually connected to the audience. Now, I'm very curious to know, and I know that there's a thing called the artist formerly known as Goldust, and that involves stuff, and I don't know how exactly that plays out, but I'm curious to know if he comes out in makeup again, if he doesn't, like, how they're going to play his character going on from this, because this whole promo segment did make me connect to him, like Dustin Runnels, like the guy. It made me a little more interested in him. And
isn't it funny how sit-down promos with real intentions can actually get you over?
Yeah. Funny it works.
Jim Ross, all of a sudden, the lights go out and Jerry Lawler's like, what's going on? Which I was kind of asking that question myself.
Yeah, same.
But Jim Ross is speaking to The Undertaker backstage, who is in the bowels of the arena somewhere.
I guess. And I mean, they did his whole theme again. I was like, we just heard The Undertaker's theme. What's he doing now? But he was just doing an interview, I guess.
And he tells Paul Bearer he's got some dark secrets that should never see the light of day. But as for Farouk, Farouk has left The Undertaker no choice, but he's going to need to unleash a demon to help him do battle against the Nation of Domination. I'm sure you've probably got the whole phrase if you liked it enough.
As far as Farouk and my physical conditioning, I have never won a match with my physical conditioning. It's always been my mental state of mind. Yep. The Nation of Destruction will all rest in peace. The Nation of Destruction, he calls them.
Well, because that's what they've been doing. They've been putting destruction everywhere.
They have been very destructive, that's true.
So, yeah, Undertaker Farouk, I'm weirdly more into it than I was at, than I was at the time. Because I'm getting to see... We're still on Raws that I've not seen fully.
I think I'm still into it in the sense that I like Farouk going for a belt that he and his people have never been able to go for. That's what compels me about this. It's not necessarily The Undertaker, and this isn't even a dig at The Undertaker. I know that, you know, everyone expects me to just have a dig at The Undertaker all the time. But it's not. Like, I feel like The Undertaker, it could have been anyone. And I would be into this just by virtue
of
I'm just glad
that he wasn't fighting Mankind again, to be honest.
Yeah, it's good to take a break from that.
Then we have a boring as fuck four-way tag match.
True. I love a good elimination match. Don't get me wrong. This wasn't the greatest elimination match.
Yeah, horrible. It's Owen and Davey, the Headbangers, the New Blackjacks, and Furnace on the Fawn. It comes down to Owen and Davey against the Headbangers. Pretty sloppy. We get the running power slam by Bulldog and Thrasher. Well, but my favorite part of it is, like, so the whole idea of this four-way match is that, like, you know, anybody from any team can be in the ring at the same time, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it comes down to Owen and Mosh are the legal men, but Bulldog pins Thrasher with a running power slam.
And wins,
and
JR, for some reason.
JR, when, like, you know, Mike Chioda's raising the hands of Owen and Bulldog, and JR's like, neither man was legal, but who's counting?
Yeah. You know? He's just like, apparently that doesn't matter in this match, because whatever. Like, you can tell JR's just like, for fuck's sake, why am I paying more attention to this than anyone in the ring? But, yeah, this wasn't great. Apparently, are we setting up a Furnace and LaFawn versus the Blackjacks feud? Because LaFawn gets pinned by Wyndham after a clothesline, and then during the ad, he grabs Bradshaw's foot and causes Bradshaw to get eliminated. And I'm not like super stoked about it, but I'm kind of, like, I'm glad that it's a secondary tag story, because the tag division is so shite normally.
Do you know where you can find this secondary tag story?
Probably not on any of the shows we're going to be watching.
Shotgun Saturday Night.
I will not be watching it then.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, fair play. Fair play for setting up another story. If I had all the time in the world to just watch Retro Raw and didn't have any other interests in my life other than 1997 WWF, I might pay attention to it, but it's just not going to happen.
That then, you know, once the match is finished, we get the whole Hart Foundation down, and Bret Hart says that before he mentions his surprise, he wants to tell the whole Hart Foundation to go to the back. He tells Austin that if Austin's thinking about covering the ring, just remember there's a pack of lions that will rip you to shreds if you do. He calls it Shawn Michaels. Shawn Michaels comes out dressed like he is going to a country club and he's 57 years old.
True. I mean, I know we always talk about how Doc Hendricks looks way older at this point in time.
Well.
Well, but doesn't Shawn Michaels also look like he is in his 50s? I mean, not facially, but...
No, facially looks young, but God, he dresses like an old man.
He really does. The loafers and everything.
Oh, I hate loafers so much.
Like loafers on some people. Hideo Itami can rock loafers with no socks, but Hideo Itami is a very beautiful man, so that'll happen.
He's one of those fashionable people that can just do anything. But basically, Bret calls Shawn out, and Bret basically... Now, the original story here, what's really good about the network, actually, to be fair, is that... So the original story was, Bret Hart was coming out, he would talk for a while, there'd be a point where Shawn Michaels would then super kick him, and then that would lead to the Hart Foundation coming out, Steve Austin made the save, blah, 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 blah. But what happened was, Bret Hart went too long, and the show went off the air mid-speech. Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart, who were already going through some issues with each other, Shawn Michaels saw this as a slight, which, to be fair to him, I can see why he would think that.
This is one of those stories of, you know, the lead up to the Montreal Screwjob that they always mention is this segment here. Because Bret talked too long and the super kick happened off air. And
but what's good is the network shows you the off-air portion as well, which is really helpful.
Because they go off the air and they say, well, keep our cameras rolling. And then there's, you know, a pause and then it goes back to the footage. So you do get to see the full story. And I was glad. I was glad we got to see the whole thing, even though, you know, I've seen it before because this is in every Montreal documentary thing ever, right? Like the moment where they almost had reconciled, Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. They had almost kind of come to terms and they were going to do this segment and it was going to go really well and they were going to build to their feud. And then Shawn Michaels no longer trusted Bret Hart. And that sort of set them off the rails. And I can see, I can. And I, to be fair, again, I think Bret does go on for a while. I think Bret Hart is good on the microphone, but I don't think he's good at reining it in. Kind of like me sometimes when I go off on tangents, right?
The amount of times I've thought, she is just Bret Hart. Happens a lot.
You know, it's fair.
I think the thing that's, I mean, Bret Hart is very, very brutally honest about a lot of things. And I think if he had really intentionally done this, he would have owned up to it. I don't think he would have lied. So my gut says that it was a mistake, but I think it was just like the worst time.
I think it was the worst time for a mistake to happen. And I think that's part of Bret Hart. I mean, when we started Retro Raw, right? Like when Bret Hart came back, I said, he's not good on the microphone. He does not look comfortable out there. And I think that he's gotten so much better as the storyline has come a little bit closer to reality and he's actually gotten to air some actual grievances. But I think actual control of the mic in terms of not just controlling the crowd and controlling his speech and controlling the mic work, also having to fit that in with the timing of a live television program, that's a lot to handle. And I don't think he's that seasoned at doing that at this point. So I think it was probably an honest mistake, but I can understand on Shawn Michaels' part too that this mistake is happening right now and this mistake is costing Shawn Michaels his big moment to super kick Bret Hart out of the wheelchair. And this is costing them, like, that's the big, like, crux of the story is the super kick and the Hart Foundation attacking Shawn Michaels afterward and then Austin coming out. And, like, that's the really important part of this. The rest of that promo could have been cut. Like, I could see where Shawn was like, no, you just needed to get your shit in.
Yeah, so because the fans at home, all they see is, like, Bret talking.
Bitching.
Not that many people are going to be like, I'm going to tune into the weekend show just to see what happened, you know. So
because where did they actually play this footage? Did they? Well, I mean, I'm asking if they play it on Raw. I'll find out, I guess, next week. But
they will show it on Raw. But they showed it on LiveWire. They showed it on Shotgun Saturday Night. They showed it everywhere, okay. So that people got to see it. It's interesting. That it happened the way that it did. So, you know, Bret brings Shawn out. Bret talks about, you know, he's the epitome of America, arrogant, cocky, thinks he's better than everyone else. He basically just berates Shawn Michaels, and Shawn Michaels takes his sports jacket off. Shawn's actually pretty good here in terms of how he reacts to Bret, which is a shame because the time that he's actually all right is when he fucks him.
Right. And
Bret just berates him, screwed him at the WWF title at WrestleMania 12, didn't have the guts to face him in a rematch at WrestleMania 13. Poses for girly magazines and gets his navel pierced and his ears and his nose. And I don't
you
think
were too
Shawn
busy
Michaels
putting tattoos on yourself and putting earrings through your navel and your nose and your ears. That line just made me laugh for some reason.
Yeah, it's
he also calls him a self-professed degenerate.
The references are coming. And as he's kind of just having a go at Shawn, you know, talking about posing for girly magazines and all his piercings, JR's like, well, we'll keep the cameras rolling. And then Bret basically gets Sweet Chin Music, which is a beautiful bump off that wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
And then Shawn runs away from the Hart Foundation for a fair amount of time, to be honest. In and out of the ring. He loses a shoe at one point.
He does. And that's then how you know things are getting intense, is if a shoe comes off.
Yeah, I would agree. When a shoe comes off, business is taking place. So it's like the one strap singlet.
Mm-hmm.
When the strap comes down, things are going to happen. And then basically the Hart Foundation are beating the shit out of Shawn Michaels. Steve Austin makes the save on the top of the ramp. And that's kind of the chaos that leaves the end of this. This is kind of the last week that we really think we're going to get Bret and Shawn at King of the Ring. Do you know what matches take place at King of the Ring? I'm not going to tell you, but do you know?
I can't remember with any clarity. Like, I feel like I know. I feel like when I see them, I'll be like, oh, these are the matches. But I don't know. And I know that I also intentionally didn't look at the description for the next pay-per-view because I think that it told me, and now I can't remember. Like, Steve Austin is in the semifinals or the finals, but... Or no, because he's not even in the bracket. What am I even thinking about?
Yep. But yeah, anyway, it's, you know, there's stuff.
There's so stuff. I've been trying, like, I've been actively trying not to remember if I accidentally find something out. So I think it's working.
But we do not get Sean and Brett King of the Ring. I want to just tell people that because I don't want people to, there'll be people who listen to this who are excited that it might be happening. It's not going to happen, just so we know.
Well, I mean, I was really surprised that this is even happening because Bret Hart just had knee surgery. So I didn't expect the segment. It's weird because I was thinking during Cold Day in Hell, actually, I was like, okay, so Bret's in a wheelchair. And I know that one segment where they had all of this dissension was when Bret was in a wheelchair. So I'm betting that's going to come up in the next few weeks. I expected it in like a month because I figured if you have knee surgery, you're probably not going to be just, you know, wrestling real soon. I didn't expect it to happen this week because Bret just had knee surgery. Like, it's all happening pretty quickly, and Shawn Michaels had to go home because he lost his smile, but okay.
Yep, pretty much. But I thought the segment was decent, but I think, you know, if you just watched Raw and didn't get to see the ending, it's just Bret rambling, really.
I think I was only as interested in it as I was because I knew that it was this segment. Like, yeah. Otherwise, it just would have been another Bret Hart interview where I would have been like, you talked at the beginning of the show. Why are you talking again?
I would concur. What is your thumb ratio for this particular episode of Raw is War?
I would say thumbs up for this one. I was pretty intrigued. I mean, even the kind of terrible tag match was intriguing because there was a secondary tag story that apparently I'm never going to see. And the Scott Putski thing was so short that it didn't matter, and I got to see Leaf Cassidy, and you know, I was really excited about that. And it was RVD versus Jeff Hardy, which sort of blew my mind in 1997. So I feel like it was a thumbs up, and not necessarily for the reasons that I would normally give a show a thumbs up, but also the Hart Foundation stuff was really good, and Farouk and the Nation of Domination have become way more compelling.
Yeah, they have, but tenfold.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a thumbs up for me. I thought there was some interest, but Farouk really stepping up. I hadn't really seen him do it before. We had the Steve Austin promo, which was really good. The Hart Foundation were fun. RVD Jeff Hardy was good. JR's reaction to Leaf Cassidy made my life. Just happy times.
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty good. It was good to have an enjoyable episode of Raw.
Mm-hmm. Long may it continue. Sandra, where can people find you on Twitter?
Find me on Twitter at SandraRuthRW. Find Kenny on Twitter at KennyMC1985. Follow Inside the Ropes at Inside_the Ropes. And I know we talked about it a lot at the beginning of the show, but Patreon.com/InsideTheRopes for all sorts of bonus content. YouTube.com/InsideTheRopes for a bunch of interviews and other content that's up on YouTube right now. More to come. There are still a bunch of AJ interviews that are coming up. Those clips are really good, so I recommend checking them out. I actually get excited when they get posted because I haven't seen them yet, so check them out.
Yeah, so do check them out. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting us on Patreon and YouTube and these podcasts and all that good stuff. And just remember, Randy Orton on Twitter is the best Randy Orton.
It's way better than the Randy Orton in the ring or on SmackDown.
What would you say to that Randy Orton, though?
To all Randy Ortons, I would say boo.
Thanks for listening.
But I'm supposed to boo the heels. It's the way it's supposed to go. Bye.
We are the Nation of Domination!
Come alive and in color. Don't diss the man. Over bum rush your mother. Listen what I'm saying. It's for real, not playing. Farouk is the man. Hit your knees and start praying.
Nation, domination.
Got power like the bear, but quick like the cat. Put two and two together. Feel your face on the mat. You count the stars while the ref counts three. Hope you like the look and feel us, cause that's all you're gonna see.
We are the Nation. Domination.
He's harder than a rock and he can't be stopped. You suckers step to the side unless you wanna get dropped. The boys from the hood are on the MIC. Spitting out the rhymes, JC Ice and Wolfie D. Clarence Mason is the boss, crossing T's and dotting I's. He tells the truth, the whole truth, and never tells a lie.